Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start the show by turning our attention to oceans. Life on Earth and other planets as well is only possible because of the presence of oceans. And that's why we study them. And we have some folks who are doing studies on oceans. And here to talk about her research on our oceans is Hannah Zanowski. Hannah's an assistant professor. She's in the UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And you will probably recall we have regular guests the last Monday of every month, our weather guys from that same department, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. So she's a member of that department. She's also a member of the Advisory Council for the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. And I'm going to ask her some more about that as we move along, too. So we'll talk with her about what oceans can tell us about, maybe about the past, maybe about our future. And you can join the conversation as well. And I hope you will. You can call us. The number's 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or shoot an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Hannah Zanowski, welcome. Thanks for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you very much. I'm super excited to be here.
So you study oceanography. What the heck is that?
So I am a physical oceanographer, which means that I study basically how the ocean works, how it moves, and how it changes over time.
And the focus of your research is polar.
Yes, it is.
And paleo.
And paleo.
Or oceanography. Okay, so.
And exoplanets.
How the heck, how did you get involved in all this or interested? What's your background that led to this?
So I was always actually interested in astronomy from a young age. I originally wanted to do astrophysics growing up. This has always been a theme for me. And then in undergrad, I double majored in math and physics, and stumbled across oceanography by taking this huge 1,000-person oceanography class. And I had a professor who was absolutely amazing, and I fell in love with the ocean because of that. So I ended up studying the ocean instead as a result, but my interest in astronomy never truly left me, so I've just found my way back into exoplanet science because we're at this point now where we can kind of think about climate on planets outside of our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bit about how I ended up here.
So, and you did your research at Princeton, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I got my PhD at Princeton University in Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So I studied, I got into polar oceanography there mostly, where I was actually studying the Southern Ocean, which is the ocean that surrounds Antarctica, and specifically thinking about how changes in the surface Southern Ocean are communicated to the very deep parts of the global ocean. And I use a bunch of climate models to look at that. So climate models are just millions and millions of lines of computer code that help us model Earth and in its past and potentially in its future as well.
So how does the, let's take the Arctic then, since that's your kind of your
it's bread and butter nowadays.
Your favorite. How does the Arctic Ocean behave under changing climate conditions?
Yeah, so right now, the biggest thing about the Arctic in terms of how it's changing is how much sea ice is covering the Arctic Ocean. Right? So sea ice is just frozen ocean itself, and so it melts throughout the course of the year and then refreezes in the winter. But the total amount of sea ice that's covering the Arctic Ocean has reduced over time, especially in the satellite era or thinking about even before then, that has changed a bunch. Right? And so,
how big is that area, by the way? I mean, is it the size of Texas, the two sides?
Several millions of square kilometers. Yeah, maybe something like that. That's probably a little bit big. I should be a little careful here number-wise in terms of sea ice, since I think more about the ocean. But yes, it's quite a large reduction in sea ice area. So it's not totally gone, but we're moving toward potentially having summers in the Arctic where we're mostly ice-free, you know, maybe by mid-century or so. And so what we mean by that, ice-free from a scientific perspective, is less than a million square kilometers. So still ice, but a lot less cover than there used to be. And so ice cover is really important for thinking about how the ocean moves, because ice is really good. Here, I'm getting stuck in my cords here. Ice is really good at damping interaction between the atmosphere and the ocean. So the atmosphere and the ocean are always talking to each other in terms of exchanging gases. The atmosphere forces the ocean. And what we mean by that is when the winds blow over the ocean, they move the water around. That's what drives our surface currents that you might be familiar with, like the Gulf Stream, things like that. There are currents in the Arctic Ocean as well, right? And so when you get rid of sea ice, you kind of make it easier for the atmosphere and the ocean to kind of interact with each other, and you also make it easier to sort of change the dynamics, or basically how the circulation works within the Arctic itself. So big thing is reduction of sea ice. Also, temperatures are just increasing overall in the Arctic as well, which is why the sea ice is partly going away, right? Yeah. So fundamentally different from what it normally is.
Thinking about Lake Mendota here on campus, and 100 years or so of research on when the ice starts and when it goes out.
Right.
And it's narrowing.
Right, reducing the season for freeze up and thaw, right?
Yeah, and from the sound of it, then the same thing is happening.
That is also happening in the Arctic, yes. So the melt season is starting earlier. And then the freeze-up is starting later, right? So the overall time at which you actually have sea ice present in the Arctic Ocean, or thick sea ice, is getting smaller as well. So you're changing sort of the seasonal cycle of the Arctic, too.
So what's happening then is with the oceans when this amount of ice decreases, do the oceans, I'm guessing they absorb more solar energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you get rid of ice, so ice, the other impact that sea ice has is that it's, since it's white, it's very reflective, right? So when you get rid of ice, the ocean is dark, so it actually absorbs more solar, incoming solar energy. And so that helps warm the ocean. And so a warming ocean behaves differently than something that's a little bit colder, right? Like I said, you can change the circulation, but a warmer ocean also takes up more volume, right? It takes up more space, right,
okay,
than a colder ocean at the same, you know,
yeah,
same mass. So this is an important component of sea level rise, is actually just the thermal component of warming the ocean up. It's not just that we dump ice from the continents into the ocean. It's also this thermal piece as well.
So the effect of that, of course, is higher ocean level, water levels. And does it affect the temperatures and the, and the way the atmosphere operates?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, that feeds back on the atmosphere, which then feeds back on the ocean and so on down the road, right? And so you kind of get into these sort of positive feedback loops where one sort of mechanism reinforces the other, and that moves your ocean or part of your ocean or bits of your climate into a different state, right?
Yeah, so you study, I mean, you study the polar oceans. You've probably at least looked at the equatorial oceans. Do they behave differently?
They most certainly do. Well, right, they're not ice covered, right? So they're not going to be subject to the same sort of ice cover dynamics as as in the polar regions. I don't spend too much time thinking about them these days, but they're going to be really important for things like large-scale climate patterns like the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or El Niño, right, which actually does impact Wisconsin to some degree. Dan Vimon is a great person to talk to about this, who's also in my department. So kind of thinking about the feedbacks between the atmosphere and the ocean, the equatorial regions are really, really quite important.
So how has the circulations, I don't know if you can answer this.
Go for
it. How's the circulation of the oceans on Earth affected the evolution of life on our planet?
That is a big question.
That's a very big question. That's why I've hesitated to even bring it up.
No, it's fine. That's the question I would like to answer, right? So that's part of what really guides my research, is trying to understand what the ocean, the physical ocean's role is in either setting up, you know, or kind of creating a good environment for the sort of precursors for life, or in thinking about how do I want to say this? Basically, how that circulation then perhaps impacted the evolution of life on our planet. So, you can kind of think about this. There are time periods where if the ocean circulation slows down, and this could be thinking about in the deep past, like many hundreds of millions of years ago, when we may have been a fully glaciated, fully ice-covered planet, right? Your ocean mm-hmm. circulation is going to be really, really different at that time. You're going to have much less exchange with the atmosphere. You're not going to have a lot of renewal between the atmosphere and the ocean. And that makes it harder for life to do its thing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how we like to think about this. And so that's maybe one example about thinking about, you know, snowball type Earth, but Earth has changed so much from a climate perspective over the, you know, it's 4.5, give or take, billion year history. So billion with a B, right? Mm-hmm. And the ocean has existed for over 4 billion years on this planet. Which is incredible. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of my new favorite facts about the ocean is that it's incredibly ancient and almost as ancient as our planet. So I want to think about basically how changes in circulation over these many billions and billions of years in these different time periods sort of interacted with life on our planet or made it easier for life to potentially take hold. And so, like I said, I'm not a biologist or a chemist, so I don't really do that piece, but I'm coming at it from trying to understand that physical environment and how that then sets things up to make life happy possible. Or not so much.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Willem in Colfax has a question for you. Let's go there.
All right, let's
Willem.
Do it.
Hi. I wondered if, you know, with the current political system in our country and the leadership of the president calling climate change a hoax and the cuts to all kinds of science in regards to climate change and its effects, how does that affect your scientific work, and what's your opinion about the idea that climate change is a hoax?
Mm-hmm. Really appreciate that question. It is not a hoax. That's it. Full stop. Climate change is real. You are experiencing it right now, and you will continue to experience it unless we actually stop burning fossil fuels. From a funding perspective, this is what's happening right now is deeply problematic for the research that I do, especially thinking about the Arctic Ocean and how that might change in the future. Basically, all of my colleagues in my department are impacted by this to some degree. And depending on what the fallout is when we finally pass a budget, it could be really, really dire, like extremely detrimental to what we do. And the reality is if we just stop doing it here, that's not going to make it better. We just won't know better. So I think that's maybe the most direct thing that I can say. But yes, it has thrown us all for quite a loop. It's a lot of hurry up, scramble, try to figure out plan A, B, C, D, and then some new piece of information drops where you're like, all right, I have to go back to the drawing board and figure out how I'm going to, you know, potentially protect my students, right? So my grants fund my students mostly. Mm-hmm. They fund people who are trying to do PhDs or master's degrees in these fields because they want to make the world a better place. And they're interested in understanding the Earth. And so I think a world or at least a United States in which we don't do that really harms us all.
Hannah Zanowski, our guest today, assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and she also serves on the advisory council for the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. As we talk with her about her ocean research, I hope you'll join in as well with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about robotic space rovers and how to get them unstuck from the surface of the moon and elsewhere with our guest Dan Negroot from Mechanical Engineering at UW-Madison. But right now, we're taking a look at the ocean research being done by Hannah Zanowski from UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And again, join in with your own questions, comments at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Hannah, you mentioned modeling earlier. Let's get into that a little bit more. How do you use models, or how are they used in this kind of research?
Yeah, so there's lots of different types of models. The one I use are these big, honkin', fully coupled climate models. And what that means is they have individual components for the atmosphere, the ocean, the land, and the plants on it, as well as ice sheets. So the ice that's actually on top of land. So ice sheets are over Antarctica, Greenland, for example, right now. As well as some models, like Earth system models, will also have biogeochemistry in them as well. So that's thinking about biology and chemistry together in the ocean atmosphere components to some degree. And then sea ice is the other really important piece of this. So we put all these things together and we can use them then. It's a sort of, all they're doing at the end of the day is trying to integrate these equations of how the Earth works forward in time, or, you know, thinking about in the past as well. So we use them for a variety of questions, especially to try and understand what our future world will look like if, for example, we continue to burn fossil fuels at the rates that we do, or maybe we increase that rate, or maybe we go through some sort of mitigation process over the course of the century. And they're kind of this tool we have to look at these big picture changes. And so say we'll run them out to the end of the 21st century. So in year 2100, you know, what's the average global air temperature going to be at the surface, right? So the place where we live, right? We can ask things like that. You can ask how much sea ice, you know, might be left in the Arctic if I'm curious about that, right? Or what areas are going to be so hot, for example, or so humid that, you know, large swaths of the population, you know, on our planet might be impacted that, like in the tropics. You can ask many, many different questions. You can diagnose how the ocean circulation might change. All of those pieces are in there as well. So that's what we do.
So if you plug in temperature increase, let's say, or you plug in something in a change, And then the model kind of recalibrates? Is that
that's
kind of how it works?
Kind of how you think about it. You won't necessarily plug in a temperature change. I mean, you could. You can say, okay, I want sometimes, for example, like, let's say we take what our modern day carbon dioxide levels are right now, which are something like 420 parts per million. We'll say, let's run this forward in time until that, you know, we force this with until this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has doubled from what it is, right? So often it's external parameters like that, and then we let the model run forward in time and then tell us sort of this is what things might look like, right? So at the end of the day, like I said, they're still just following these basic physical equations. It's just that, you know, they're written up in computer code and it's allowed to sort of behave in the way that it will. And you get these very different sort of solutions because the Earth is inherently we can describe the Earth and its sort of behavior by very complex equations that are inherently chaotic.
So if you plug that description or that example that you used into the computer, mm-hmm. how long does it take to plug it in, and how long does it take to get the... I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, it's a great question.
How long does it take for the computer to...
to spit something out. It actually takes quite a bit of real time. It also depends on the resolution of your model. So we're not... When we model the Earth like this, we actually have to what we call discretize our equations, which means we model the Earth as like points on a grid, right? So thinking about like latitude or longitude or something like that, right? And the finer or closer those points are together, or the finer your grid, the longer in general it takes, because there's just more steps within the process of all these different processors and things in the computer that are talking to each other. And the more you add, more processes that you add in each of the components of your system adds to that. So for example, if you want, you need to kind of run a climate model for a period of time when you start it from scratch to get up to something we call steady state, quote unquote, which is just the, you know, things are not changing a ton anymore. So they're kind of reaching its like mean or average state. And typically for most climate models, because the ocean likes to do things slowly, this, you need at least 1,000 years of model runtime to do that. That's not 1,000 real human years. otherwise we'd be here for, you know, we wouldn't be very good at our job, right? But, that can take, depending on the model, can take, you know, weeks to months of real time. Like, it's a pretty serious endeavor.
Computers are
You need supercomputers. Yeah, supercomputers are the way to go. So you need, like, many, you know, thousands of processors or cores to kind of, or hundreds of them, depending on the model, right, to do that. So it takes a lot to run that.
It sounds like it. Well, Dot in Manitowoc has a question for you. So let's go there. Dot, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. What is the explanation of global warming when the glaciers in Wisconsin melted? We certainly didn't have any cars or what was the explanation for that?
Sure.
Yeah, so you mean like when the last sort of glaciers actually retreated from where they were when they were kind of hanging out here in Wisconsin, like, you know, at the last glacial maximum 15,000 years ago. Yeah, so it was still an increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So what was happening by and large is that there was a lot of carbon dioxide actually stored in the ocean. And then over time, as things kind of slowly come out of that state, right, the ocean is more vigorous, it exchanges more with the atmosphere, and it sort of brings some of that back out. So it's kind of an important piece for that. It also draws down the carbon as well. So you can kind of put things in there. But CO2 is a greenhouse gas. And so what that basically means is that it kind of helps warm our atmosphere. Right? And so that's part of it in terms of that time period is kind of how I would.
So it warmed a bit.
Yeah.
And the CO2 then that escaped from the ice.
Or the ocean. And that has a feedback in the atmosphere where you continue to warm then, and then you melt your ice back, and then you continue to warm, right? And so the ocean itself can take up or outgas carbon depending on what the circulation is. So you either bring it into the ocean, right? So CO2 dissolves as a gas, or you can spit it back out. And the timescales over which that happen are really variable. So things like glacial and interglacial cycles, so we're thinking about like many thousands of years, like this question that Dot was asking, it is related to the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's not the only thing, but that's kind of a big question for it.
Yeah.
Right? So it wasn't people that kicked us necessarily out of that, but the Earth also has these, you know, periods of change that are natural in addition to what we're doing to it now.
Yeah, and so we're just speeding up the process.
Yes. What we've been doing is, in the last, like, 200 years-ish since the pre-industrial era, is unprecedented in the last 800,000.
have made a big difference.
Yes, it's huge.
Yeah. So John wants to know, how do ocean temperatures and currents affect the climate, say, in the upper Midwest?
In the upper Midwest. All right. So I don't think too much about this here. Like I said, I think the biggest things are going to be that when you, like in the tropics, where we were talking about El Nino earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
Changes within the Pacific Ocean are actually sort of spread out across the planet through what we call atmospheric teleconnections. All right. So the Pacific Ocean talks to the atmosphere, and then the atmosphere goes and kind of talks to its other parts in other places. Right. So sometimes climate in the Midwest can then be impacted by that. But also in terms of just how, when you change the ocean circulation overall, you are kind of fundamentally changing what the global average surface temperature is. And that is going to impact then maybe a little bit what we feel in Wisconsin. But the details of that, though, are very dependent on other factors that might influence it more. So the ocean matters a lot, but it's not necessarily, you know, every single day.
Yeah.
I don't want you to think that, like, how do I want to say this? That, you know, if you have a bad storm here right now, that was the oceans, you know, doing that. It's just that overall, on average, its role is to sort of impact planetary climate as a whole. And then that does actually feed back down at this very regional level at which we live.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So is that a...
Yeah, it makes good sense. Hannah Zanowski, our guest today, you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You're looking at exoplanet oceans.
Yes, I am.
Why the heck would you want to do that?
So because why stop planet, at one ocean?
Yeah, so what's out there that's going to make a difference here?
What's all that's going to make a difference here? Well, I'm interested in oceans on exoplanets because I am fundamentally interested in this question about, are we alone in the universe?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so we know that life got started on this planet. We don't actually know how that happened. Mm-hmm. And so the hope is that by studying Earth and studying planets elsewhere, we might be able to answer some of those questions, but especially the are we alone bit. And I think, I mean, maybe I'm biased since I am an oceanographer, but I have a sense that oceans are going to be a really important piece of that puzzle simply because of the amount of liquid water that they can hold, right? And the fact that oceans themselves can be really stable features or stabilizing features of a planet's climate, which I think is important for long-term. So for a planet to sort of behave similarly over very, very long periods of time, and I do fundamentally think that's important for life to take hold, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you think about it, like life on our planet formed potentially up to like 4.1-ish billion years ago, at least definitely by 3.5 billion or 3.8 billion years ago. But it was very primitive microbial life for a really, really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of need an environment where things don't get too wild necessarily, or at least something that can help bring your environment back to normal with all of these major climate changes that were happening. You know, Earth was a really violent place early on. You know, you're thinking about when it cools off, just geologically speaking, like volcanism, all of these things, some of these mass extinctions we've had in the last like 500 million years or so are related to major changes to the Earth system itself, to the climate, to things like volcanism. Not obviously the case of the dinosaurs, where it was an external asteroid impact, right? But many of the other ones were actually just related to Earth going through periods of unrest. So,
yeah. Jim in Webster has a question. Mm-hmm. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Pleased to be here. I just read a book about the Milankovitch cycles from the Serbian scientist, and he kind of worked out that the tilt of the Earth varies, and then the roundness of the orbit varies from very round to fairly egg-shaped, and then when the maximum temperature in the northern hemisphere occurs in terms of distance to the sun, and it's weird because right now we are closest to the sun for the northern hemisphere for our winter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I can't remember. It's one's 20,000-year cycle. One's they're kind of overlapping cycles that aren't lined up necessarily with each other. A lot of it has to do with, of course, old man Jupiter out there tugging on the whole solar system. So
yeah.
I just thought maybe that'd be an interesting point to bring up. But I'll listen.
Okay, thanks for calling. Comments, Hannah?
Yeah, so Milankovitch cycles, you're exactly right. You did pretty well on the numbers. They're about 20,000 to 23,000 years, 40,000 to 43,000 years. So one of them's the obliquity, like you're talking about, the tilt of the Earth's axis, right? And then there's precession, which is sort of relating to how the Earth rotates around its own axis as related to that tilt as well. That one's a little bit complicated to explain, so we're just going to kind of sweep it under the rug right now. At least complicated to explain without lots of, you know, diagrams. And then the last one is eccentricity, right? Which is that how circular or you know, elliptical your orbit is, right? And those do also impact climate on those long-term glacial, interglacial timescales. So you're exactly right about that, and we factor that in when we think about climate and climate change. So when I said that, you know, what we're doing to our planet right now is unprecedented, at least in the last 800,000 years, we have ice cores that give us a record of sort of what gases in the atmosphere were like during those time periods, because the bubbles get trapped in the ice over time. And then we use that as a proxy for understanding what atmospheric temperature, for example, was in those periods. And what we see are these very big, long-term sort of dips and increases in temperature like that. And those are very clear indications of Milankovitch cycles, right? And so, yes, definitely that's part of this, and it's something we think about all the time. So, yeah, great job picking up on that and remembering all the numbers. So,
good job.
So like, yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bruce in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. My question is that Earth is kind of unusual in that we have a very large moon that creates a lot of tidal stirring of the ocean. So I've been wondering how much effect that has had on the development of life in the oceans and the currents and so on.
Yes, that's another great question. And yes, it is unusual in that regard. And so the moon, when it first formed, was a lot closer to our planet, right? And it has slowly sort of drifted away. And that's sort of turned into sort of energy that's like our planet is slowly, you know, increasing or decreasing its rotation rate here, right? And so there are some studies that, you know, would indicate that the moon has been a really important piece of potentially life developing on our planet, or at least potentially an important factor, right? We can't definitively say that, like, yeah, if we didn't have a moon, we wouldn't have life on this planet or anything like that, right? But it is really important, just like you're saying, because it's important for tides, right? And so tides are a way, especially in the ocean, they diffuse, diffusing heat in the ocean by impacting sort of the stretching, shrinking of our planet, squashing here. And then, how do I want to say this, right? So you actually dissipate a lot of heat in the ocean because of tides. And there's this kind of a nice energy source and a way to keep things relatively warm or warmer than they maybe would be if you didn't necessarily have as strong of a tidal forcing because of the moon. And keeping things, like I said, in that kind of warm state is nice, especially early on. So remember when we think about the Earth's, you know, once it kind of cooled off a bit from its really like Hadean period, which is this really like fiery, awful time period, hence why it's called the Hadean, you have an ocean that maybe behaves kind of like it does today. And then you have that tidal forcing. So at this time period, though, maybe 4 billion years ago, the sun was a lot fainter than it was today, which means you have less incoming solar radiation, which means you have a colder planet overall, right? And so we still think we had a liquid water ocean in that time period for a lot of reasons. Part of it is we invoke greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, but tides are potentially one small piece of that that kind of help keep things from freezing over, right? So they're an important part of energy dissipation, but they're also really important for, just kind of thinking about how stuff can then live in the ocean.
So you said the moon's was moving away from us. It's not going away anytime soon, I wouldn't imagine.
I don't think so, but it is definitely drifting away from us. It's, I mean, like at some point, I don't know. You got to ask the astronomers about that. I shouldn't speak too much to that. We get in trouble here. Somebody's going to bust in here and be like, no.
Well, sometimes people call and say, no, you're wrong about that.
That's fine. But I will invite them to come in here and try to talk without saying anything completely incorrect for an hour.
Bruce, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jake in Watertown, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just heard the guest mention the ice kind of playing its role to reflect solar radiation. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if the Earth's magnetic field weakening gets incorporated into the computer models at all, as that could possibly be maybe the largest piece of the puzzle here.
No, we don't really think, at least in Earth system models, about the weakening of the magnetic field. So that is definitely a thing, but that isn't necessarily going to impact the amount of solar radiation that the surface receives, right? Those two things aren't necessarily connected to each other. It's true that if you weaken the magnetic field or totally get rid of it, it suddenly doesn't protect us from a lot of really harmful space environment things, like what the sun is trying to blast at us all the time. And you don't really want to be exposed to that kind of radiation because it would be really terrible. But that's not something that we necessarily incorporate in our climate models, although there are models of sort of Earth's upper atmosphere that I imagine kind of think a little bit more about these things. But it isn't something that we necessarily are saying is like, oh, this is the smoking gun for what's happening here, because it's not.
Hmm. Jake, thanks. Jane in Lancaster, we'll go to you. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I was wondering if there is any benefit to having all the plastic in the oceans that is dumped there regularly, probably daily, and if the scientist is concerned about the people in Pakistan who've developed a way to consume plastic.
I'm not sure about it. Could you say a little bit more about I'm not sure.
Yeah, they found a fungal thing that will eat plastic.
Oh.
And, you know, we are loaded up with plastic in the oceans because it's dumped there.
Yeah.
And I understand that the fish and other animals that live in the ocean are using the plastic in their bodies, and we are too.
Yes. So microplastics, right, is probably what you've heard of. There's tons of plastic in the ocean. There's these huge garbage patches in the Central Pacific and Central Atlantic Ocean because our plastic ends up in the ocean. That's generally really harmful for anything that where it ends up, right? You, me, anything that lives in the ocean that's eating that, right? And I think, yeah, I don't know a ton about the research on the bacteria that potentially, or whatever it is, that potentially eat plastic, or like what the capacity they have for breaking that down and helping sort of solve the problem, right? It could be an option, but sort of to get that to scale, I don't even know what that would look like. Also, I think the bigger thing is that we need to kind of think about single-use plastic or think about better ways to not sort of generate so much of this or reuse it in a way that it's not ending up in huge quantities in the ocean, right? It's sort of major shifts in behavior in terms of what we're doing on our planet that aren't sustainable.
Jane, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to the moon drift here for just a minute, because I got a report here. Scientists determine the rate at which the moon is drifting away from Earth. They figured that out, I guess, during the Apollo missions. NASA did. Scientists estimate the moon is straying from the Earth by about an inch and a half per year, roughly the rate at which fingernails grow.
Right.
According to NASA, and as far as will the Earth ever lose its moon, we would actually lose the moon before the sun turns into a red giant.
That's what I was wondering. I don't know. Yeah, time period wise. Okay, so the moon might go first.
On that happy note, a reminder that we're talking today about the oceans.
I know, right?
And looking, well, we got into exoplanets too with our guest, Hannah Zanowski. And you can join in too. Question, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to Home Inspector John Freiberger about dealing with mold in your home. And you know, there's going to be a lot of mold in a lot of homes here in Wisconsin after that flooding this past week. So I think it's pretty timely. We'll also talk about mass timber as building material. UW-Milwaukee Assistant Professor Alex Timmer along for that. That's tomorrow. Right now, we're taking a look at ocean research, both oceans in our world and in other worlds as well, with our guest Hannah Zanowski, Assistant Professor in the UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and also serves on the Advisory Council for the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. Happy to have her with us. Questions for her, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. And maybe talk a little bit more about I know you've got a grant to study Hycean planets, or Hycean, I guess you can pronounce it either way, Hycean planets. But before we talk about that, just tell us a little more about the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. Who's all involved in that?
Lots of folks. So WICOR is how we call it. Officially became a thing in the fall of last year. And what it is it's just several departments and then individual scientists from other departments that came together because we want to ask these questions about origins, right? So origins of life on our planet, but then are we alone in the universe, right? And so it has major questions like how does a habitable planet form? How does it behave, right? All the way out to thinking about the unique sort of chemical biological pieces of this as well. So we bring our founding departments here, and I'm probably going to get these wrong, is astronomy, atmospheric, there's six founding departments, astronomy, atmospheric, and oceanic sciences. I think botany, bacteriology, geoscience, and chemistry. And if I've lied to you about that, some department's going to be very angry at me, and I'm sorry. So we all came together because we all have these same interests in understanding them, a fundamental question, but every single department and every single research scientist who's interested in this understands fundamentally that they only hold one piece of the puzzle. And that it's this really interdisciplinary type of work where you're translating across these different fields, where I'm trying to understand chemistry at all. And somebody else is telling me about, you know, sort of prebiotic, whatever, nutrients, where we all need to kind of get together in the same room and figure out how to talk to each other and figure out how each of us has the little bits of knowledge that help us, again, put that puzzle together. And so that is why CORE's mission is to really do that. And so we have a really, really neat set of scientists and folks who are involved within this center, and it's there to ask and answer big questions.
Yeah. Well, it's a cool way to do it because we do get siloed, you know.
Yes, a ton.
On this campus. I can speak from some experience on that myself. So it's nice to be able to put people together in a group like that from all those different perspectives. And so you've got a grant to study Hycean planets or Hycean. Yeah. How do you pronounce it, by the way?
I pronounce it Hycean, but I've been told by the person who sort of wrote the first paper on this. I mean, I haven't been told this directly, but I think they pronounce it Hycean. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Pick whatever you want.
It's H-Y.
You don't always get to decide. So
it's just H-Y-C-E-A-N.
Yeah. So it's like hydrogen atmosphere or hydrogen helium atmosphere. So very light gases over a very deep liquid water ocean is this sort of type of planet that is potentially out there in the universe that may be a really good candidate for hosting life just because of necessarily its deep oceans, but in terms of having a relatively large habitable zone around host stars.
How many of those have we found?
Not many.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that we've... There's one that we think might be falling properly into this category. I think what's really hard about this is that mostly these are theorized planets in the sense that based on how you do an internal structure modeling, which is basically just sort of fitting a bunch of curves to say, if this is the mass and the radius of a planet, and again, the astronomers might get me in trouble here. Sorry, folk. If this is the mass and the radius of a planet, these are the sort of potential sort of atmosphere or, you know, rock or, you know, core or liquid water ocean or whatever potential sort of features that could exist to explain that relationship. And so there's no exoplanet that we can directly image an ocean on. So we don't have any direct evidence that there is truly an ocean. It's just based on sort of what might be in the atmosphere, or at least that we can say that it's consistent with having an ocean at this point in time. We're not at the point where we can say that definitively. So there are candidate exoplanets. So we know that they are there. That we say, okay, this could be a Hycean candidate based on this sort of mass-radius relationship and everything else that we kind of see from it, right? And so my job, though, when I study them, is to think about what the climate on those might look like, right?
So your role.
That's my role. I can't do the astronomy and I can't do the chemistry, right? And any of the other pieces of it. But we kind of, again, they can't do the oceanography, though, right? And so that's why we do this together, right? And it's because they have these really deep oceans, and I can tell you how that moves, right? And that, then, we can kind of think about how, then, that sets up exchange between that exoplanet's atmosphere and its ocean, potentially. And then that impacts what astronomers will see when they go and do spectroscopy of that planet's atmosphere. So they look... like transit spectroscopy, for example, where they kind of look at that background, like that host star's sunlight or light as it passes through that exoplanet's atmosphere. And that actually you can back out what's in it. So what is that atmosphere made of? And what that brings in this whole idea of biosignatures, which are sort of gases or things that exist within an exoplanet's atmosphere that we'd want to say are definitively something that's only produced by life. But it's really hard to say that something is definitively produced by life, because there's a lot of things out there, like oxygen, for example, that it can occur naturally. But like on our planet, we have almost, you know, we have like 21% oxygen in our atmosphere. We have that much oxygen because of life. So it can't always be a perfect biosignature. Like, we didn't always have oxygen in our atmosphere. Right. So when Earth was formed, there was no oxygen in it. It wasn't until life came up with photosynthesis and actually using carbon dioxide and then turning and having oxygen be a byproduct of that, that we started to actually have significant amounts of oxygen in our atmosphere. And it took a really long time. We're talking like billions of years still.
because the role here is to. Or the goal here is, there are a few things I think that are goals. One is to see if there's life somewhere else. But then the other goal is more of an evolutionary kind of thing, and being able to relate it to perhaps our own existence.
Yeah, so the hope too is that maybe we can learn something about our own existence or evolution of life on our own planet by potentially finding it or studying it elsewhere, or finding planets, for example, that are very early on in that process. That could be an analog for what very early Earth was like. So there's almost no geological record or rock or anything left from those time periods. So when we look that deep into the past, we have very little information, right? And so you have to have these multifaceted approaches where you're potentially looking at a different planet to learn something about your own and vice versa. You need models, you need proxies, you need people who go out and do field work, you need people who, you know, astronomers, chemists, you know, botanists, the whole nine yards. That's why, you know, again, why we're doing this, right? Everybody brings their little piece to help answer the big question.
And so is that what your lab, and by your lab, you might just say your lab is a collection of yourself, graduate students primarily?
Yeah, so it's me, and I have a very small lab. And I mean, realistically, because of my job being climate modeling or using climate models, I just need a supercomputer. So it's not usually even done here at the university. But I need my laptop. That's kind of all I need for my lab. So it's usually me and like a couple grad students. I have two and a half grad students right now. And then maybe one or two undergrads who are just interested in doing some kind of research and getting involved in that. Right. And so we'll either analyze output from climate models, or we'll think about running little simulations about, you know, what Earth could have looked like in the really deep past, or how an exoplanet might behave if you have different physical conditions, like if the planet's bigger, if it rotates faster, all of these sorts of things. And so we use computers as our toolbox to do that.
And you're training those folks. Mm-hmm. And they may, you're still pretty young, so you're training them, they will train others who will eventually replace you.
Yeah, definitely. That's the hope. But I mean, the idea is that I'm not training people to be my replacement, right? I'm training them to be their own person, right? And their own, to follow what's interesting to them in that way. So.
And you're doing this research and a lot of work in that, but you also teach.
Yes, I sure do.
And that's kind of I always thought it was the fun part of the job.
I love
when
it.
I was doing.
I love teaching and I love mentoring. Like we were talking earlier before we actually started the show, it's really the part of my job that gets me out of bed every day. I think it's a real honor to be able to guide the next generation of scientists, but also that they trust me enough to sort of put that process in my own, put the, you know, their well-being and their, you know, dreams in my hands as part of that. I think. It's definitely frustrating some days, right? But it's also a really magical piece about what we get to do is you get to help people figure out what really matters to them and what they want to do. And I really benefit a lot from being able to do that in my job.
Well, you're certainly a lot of fun to talk to. I bet it'd be fun to take your courses.
You should. I will school you in oceanography.
I'd probably fail miserably.
I don't know, Larry. I have hope for you.
Hannah Zanowski, assistant professor at UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Fun talking with her. And, you know, we're going to, you know, we were talking about exoplanets. We're going to talk about some planets out there where the robots, the rovers, have had some problems. And we've got a guy here who's kind of figured out how to solve that. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller.